Today is Friday, March 22nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up.
In the end, they came to a decision that this March 29th deadline had to be pushed back. It's now the 12th of April deadline.
That's Catherine Field with the latest from the EU summit. Also ahead, the death toll from Cyclone Idai in southeastern Africa continues to rise. And thousands of people gather today for a mass funeral in a cemetery in New Zealand. It's all on today's International Edition. In the past 2 years, British Prime Minister Theresa May has insisted repeatedly that Britain will exit the EU on schedule on March 29th. She had said so 108 times from the dispatch box in the House of Commons. But yesterday, the embattled leader was forced to appeal to her fellow EU national leaders for a 3-month postponement. May's face-to-face request at a summit in Brussels clearly strained the patience of the EU's other 27 national leaders, who are close to a breaking point. They fear Britain's tangled exit will never get resolved. Reporter Catherine Field is covering the summit and tells me there are other big issues on the table that leaders would rather discuss.
The first day was meant to be the EU27 leaders discussing China, disinformation and climate change. And then because of Brexit and because of the troubles that the British Prime Minister Theresa May is having getting the withdrawal agreement through Parliament, all of that was just off the table and the leaders had to discuss what the EU was going to do about Brexit. In the end, they came to a decision that this March 29th deadline had to be pushed back. It's now the 12th of April deadline, and that's the time they've given Theresa May to try and get this withdrawal agreement through her parliament. So a little bit of backwards and forward. In fact, it went right through the whole evening, and leaders traditionally start this summit meeting in the early afternoon. They then discuss a few items. They then have dinner. Well, all of that just stretched right through till midnight, just discussing Brexit. So on the one hand, they've now got it. They've got it clear. They've got the 27 remaining EU members to agree with what to do about the United Kingdom. But now it means that, yes, the ball is back in London's court, but on the other side, it means they just really have a few hours to discuss other matters which they consider really the important issues for what's facing Europe today.
And speaking of the other matters, you mentioned disinformation, climate change, and even China. So what is the agenda regarding these items?
For disinformation, this is a key. It seems as though it's everywhere at the moment, but it is particularly key for the European Union at the moment because in May they're having European parliamentary elections. This is key. This is going to go across the whole of the 27 nations. So they need to ensure cybersecurity for this. They need to ensure that their message is right. They're very, very confident that they've got the security of the vote sorted out. But really, when it comes to what information is getting out there on social media, who is putting it out there and who is controlling that information, that they need to get on top of. And they are well aware of what had happened in the United Kingdom with the Brexit vote, and they're also well aware of what is happening on other social medias at the moment. Then you've got climate change. Now, they are really particularly concerned that this has been sort of pushed into a small item for this particular summit because the European Union has to come up with a long-term strategy for dealing with climate change. That long-term strategy, according to the Paris Climate Agreement, has to be done, dusted, signed off by 2020. Now, that's a tall order when you suddenly realize that a matter that you had 6 hours to discuss is now perhaps down to 1, possibly 1.5 hours, and you've got to get agreement for 27 countries on that. So that in particular is being sort of pushed to one side. The other, as you quite rightly say, the other very important issue is China, trade and diplomatic relations with China. The Chinese president is in Europe at the moment. He arrived in Italy on Thursday. He's coming to France on the weekend. On Sunday, he will start a state visit. This is very important for Europe. Europe recognizes that China is a key global player, and it has to deal with the issue of trade, competition, and also technological security. These matters of China have to be dealt with. And it's very interesting that the French President Emmanuel Macron has called on his German counterpart, the Chancellor Angela Merkel, to come to Paris next Tuesday and to sit down with the Chinese President at the Elysee Palace. And there, they're going to discuss climate change and they're going to discuss industrial policy.
That was reporter Catherine Field in Paris. Well, southeastern Africa continues to rise. There are now more than 600 dead in Mozambique, Malawi, and Zimbabwe, and rescue workers expect to find more bodies in the coming days. Hundreds of thousands of people remain displaced by floodwaters, and the world is rushing aid to the battered region. The World Food Program is coordinating international aid efforts. Lola Castro is the WFP Southern Africa director and says the aid effort is a massive undertaking. She spoke via Skype with my colleague, Jeffrey Young.
WFP, basically, as you know, we are leading the logistic cluster for the whole humanitarian community, meaning that we are not only moving our food, but also moving non-food items, water, other type of tarpaulins and buckets and stoves, everything that is available to distribute to these people together with the international community and the government. But basically, it's a humongous logistic challenge. Basically, we have deployed a couple of helicopters. Our plane, the first plane that landed with humanitarian aid in Beira, basically landed on Saturday on Bishwal, and it could not take off for 2 days because there was not adequate fuel. So you can just imagine the challenge. Other challenge is that obviously we need to really move to a very large area. We're talking around 55,000 square kilometers where people are all over the place, on the waters, on the roof of their houses. Logistical challenge is massive.
The cyclone hit essentially at this point a week ago, and that means that for the past week, there are pockets of population that have been cut off from food, from potable water, from medicine, from assistance. Describe the level of stress on a population that has been without for so many days.
People are extremely stressed. When they come out from the helicopters, you can see how wasted they are, how tired they are, how the children have to immediately be given ready-to-use foods, which are supplementary foods, which will rehabilitate them. People are also dehydrated because they really need proper water, as you very well said. The ones who are a little bit inland are drinking waters who are not good, but the people who are, you remember, these are deltas also of the Pungwe, the Busi rivers, the Rebwe, and all these deltas are between salt and fresh water. And the tidal wave that came with the cyclone, which was around 6 to 7 meters, may have salinized all the soil. So basically also the waters are salinized and people are drinking this. So very difficult situation.
Let's talk about what the people are going to need in the next couple of months, because their hospitals are destroyed. The infrastructure is destroyed. Electricity is down.
You have to get the people shelter, get the people water systems to be able to drink. Then they will have to rehabilitate their lands, if it's possible, because obviously the harvest has been washed away or they are underwater, but basically unusable. They were about to harvest this month there in this region of Mozambique and also in the area of Zimbabwe. They basically have lost all the harvest, but also all their stocks. So basically, at this moment, they need to plant immediately. But can they plant? It seems the River Pungwe has reached a highest level in 200 years, the delta. So if you imagine that, you can imagine that the waters from the sea came inland quite a lot of kilometers. And those were some of the arable land, some of the areas where they produce their vegetables to sell in the market and make the income that makes them for the lean season. So basically what we are looking for is a huge humanitarian first and immediately moving to rehabilitation and recovery. And the government is going to need a lot of support on this, and the international community will have to look into a very long term.
That was Lola Castro, the WFP Director for Southern Africa. She also told VOA's Jeffrey Young that individuals who want to help flood victims can go to www.wfp.org and donate. Well, thousands of people gathered today for a mass funeral in a cemetery in New Zealand, where 26 of the 50 victims of a mass shooting in a mosque last Friday were buried. The youngest victim buried was 3 years old. Earlier, at an outdoor service across from the mosque where the fatal attack happened in Christchurch, Imam Gamil Fuda addressed a crowd of thousands, telling them that we are brokenhearted, but we are not broken. He told them also, hate will be undone and love will redeem us. The imam thanked the neighbors who opened their doors to save them from the killer and those who pulled over their cars to help them. Women around New Zealand wore headscarves today to show their support and respect for the Muslim community. Among the top stories in the world, the National Airline of Indonesia becomes the world's first airline to publicly confirm plans to cancel an order for an American-made Boeing jetliner that has been involved in two deadly crashes in the past 6 months. Italy's prime minister will sign up his country tomorrow to China's Belt and Road Initiative, an ambitious trillion-dollar transcontinental trade and infrastructure project. And two American service members and an Afghan partner died in a joint counter-Taliban operation in northern Afghanistan today. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA's International Edition.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists with NASA's OSIRIS-REx mission to the asteroid Bennu have written a number of papers in the journal Nature that outline discoveries made since it began orbiting it on December 31, 2018. Among the findings is that particle plumes were found erupting from the surface of Bennu. While many of the plume particles completely cleared the asteroid, the scientists also report some of the ejected particles orbited Bennu and then fell back to its surface. The studies also reveal that Bennu's surface is much rougher and denser with boulders than expected. This finding is causing the mission team to change its flight and sample collection plans and locate a site that is free from such hazards. In 2020, the OSIRIS-REx will get close to the asteroid's surface, lower a collection instrument, and then gather some material that will get back to Earth in 2023. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Well, the United States President Donald Trump tweeted that it is time for the U.S. to recognize Israel's claim to the Golan Heights. The small territory on the Syria-Israeli border is part of Syria, but has been occupied by Israel since the 1967 Six-Day War. It is one of several bitterly disputed territorial issues in the Middle East. The move would represent a significant change in U.S. recognition of territory there and could anger U.S. allies in the region. VOA's Mario Ritter spoke with Tamara Wittes, a fellow with the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution in Washington.
What are your thoughts on the proposed move to recognize Israel's claim to the Golan Heights?
Look, in practice, Israel controls the Golan Heights, and that control has been uncontested since the Six-Day War in June 1967, when Israel took the territory from Syria. But recognizing Israel's sovereignty over the Golan is a very different matter than acknowledging Israel's control. Israel extended its civil law to the Golan in 1981. The United States objected to it then. Under the Reagan administration, the U.S. supported a Security Council resolution rejecting Israel's annexation of the Golan. And so what President Trump has done here is basically overturned that Reagan administration policy, but he's also undermined, at the least, one of the core principles underlying Arab-Israeli diplomacy. There is a UN Security Council Resolution 242 that was passed in the wake of the 1967 war that calls on Israel to withdraw from territories captured in the war and rejects the acquisition of territory by force. And that UN Security Council resolution is a foundational component of the Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty, of the Jordanian-Israeli peace treaty, of every Middle East peace conference convened by the United States over 40 years.
How do you think Israel's immediate neighbors would react, and also U.S. allies?
Well, if I were in the Egyptian or Jordanian government, it would make me question America's commitment to UN Security Council Resolution N242, to the principle of land for peace that underlies my own peace with Israel. And if I were one of the other Arab states, it would also make me much more reluctant to go along with what the Trump administration might be asking me to do on behalf of its own peace plan, which the White House still says it plans to roll out later this spring.
Is this an indication of a big change in U.S. policy towards Israel, especially since 2016?
Until January, it wasn't something that the Israeli government had been asking the U.S. administration to consider. There's no indication that there was an interagency process in the U.S. government that sort of sorted through the implications of this for other U.S. interests and made a sort of thoughtful analysis of the consequences.
Is Syria falling apart territorially? Is this an indication of a larger issue in Syria?
I would not take this as an indication that the territorial breakup of Syria is imminent. I think the issue of the Golan is fairly distinct from the civil conflict that has been taking place in Syria over the last 8 years. I also think that Syria's neighbors, by and large, are quite committed to the territorial integrity of Syria, including Syria's consistent desire to reclaim the Golan through negotiations with Israel. And we're already seeing reactions from the region today, from the Organization of Islamic Conference, from other governments in the region, rejecting this American move and insisting on Syria's right to the Golan and on UN Security Council Resolution 242, Land for Peace, as the basis for resolving these disputes. So I think that this is a move that puts the U.S. government very much at odds with governments in the region, not just adversaries, but many close partners as well.
Tamara Wittes, a fellow at the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution in Washington. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
This is VOA's International Edition.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Next up, the 16th anniversary of the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq and a status update on Syria and the growing role of Iran in both nations. We talk with Barbara Leaf, former U.S. ambassador to the UAE, and Ellen Lapson, professor at George Mason University. That's Encounter, Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Hello, this is James Butte, managing editor and host of VOA's Daybreak Africa show. Join us Monday through Friday at 03, 04, 05, and 0600 hours UTC as we bring you the latest Africa news, features, and thoughts. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our mail segment by sending your comments to daybreakafrica at voanews.com. That's Daybreak Africa right here on VOA Africa.
This is VOA's International Edition. The U.S. ambassador to Yemen, Matthew Teller, blamed the Iran-backed Houthi movement for the stalling of a UN-led peace plan for the main port of Hodeidah during talks in Sweden in December. The Saudi-backed Yemeni government and the Houthis reached a ceasefire and troop withdrawal deal for that port, which has been controlled by the Houthi rebels. While the truce has largely held, the troop withdrawal has yet to materialize, with both parties blaming each other for the lack of progress in implementing the pact. Adam Irelli, a former U.S. ambassador to Bahrain, spoke to VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawy about the U.S. position on the conflict in Yemen.
Well, I know Matt Tueller very well, and he knows what he's talking about. He's dealt with the Houthis. He's dealt with the Saudis. He's dealt with all the members of the coalition. He's been on the ground there. I think he's absolutely right. Time and again, the Houthis have been offered deals that they've agreed to and then proceeded to break their word. So the problem with the Houthis is they're very untrustworthy and they're very consistent. They say one thing and do another.
So while the truce has largely held, the troop withdrawal from Hodeidah has yet to materialize, with both parties blaming each other for lack of progress in implementing the Stockholm Pact. What's the way out of this situation?
Well, that's a great question. The UN Special Envoy Martin Griffiths is continuing discussions with all the parties to try to effect a withdrawal of forces as agreed to in Stockholm. You know, my sense is that, like most times during this conflict, when there's been some kind of agreement or some kind of forward movement, it's because the Houthis are under pressure and they don't have any option but to make a temporary truce or a temporary agreement in order to put an end to the pressure that's on them. So my sense is that the only way forward, frankly, is to keep the pressure on the Houthis. Otherwise, they have no incentive to compromise or to do what's in the interest of the Yemeni people.
U.S. Ambassador to Yemen said, "We are willing to work with others in order to try to implement the Stockholm Agreement and see whether the Houthis can in fact demonstrate a political maturity and start to serve the interests of Yemen rather than acting on behalf of those who seek to weaken and destroy Yemen." What options does the United States have to get involved in reaching a peaceful solution in Yemen?
Well, I think that's a great quote, particularly the part about, Houthis making the right choices for the people of Yemen. But as to what role the U.S. can play, the United States, from the beginning of this conflict, has preferred to keep the U.N. in the lead and the coalition partners in the lead. We are not a party to this conflict. I think that we certainly support the coalition. We certainly believe that the Houthis are the aggressors in this conflict. But I don't see the United States taking a leading role in the diplomacy on this issue, but rather using its influence and good offices to support both the UN Special Envoy and to support the coalition, despite the stupid moves by Congress to limit the president's ability to do that.
That was Adam Arely, a former U.S. ambassador to Bahrain. He spoke to VOA's Mohammed Elshenawy about the conflict in Yemen. Well, more than 71 people have drowned after a tour boat overturned in the swollen Tigris River near Mosul. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Amateur video showed passengers of the overturned tour boat being rapidly carried away by the swift current of the swollen Tigris River near Mosul. Bystanders along the river say most of the passengers were women and children celebrating Nowruz and that few survivors were rescued. General Saad Man, Iraqi Interior Ministry spokesman, tried to downplay the number of casualties and refused to give a precise figure for casualties. He says most of the victims were women and children going on a pleasure cruise to celebrate the spring Nowruz holiday near a well-known island outside Mosul. He says that rescue operations are ongoing, so it's impossible to give an exact figure yet for the number of dead. Iraqi human rights activist Ali Maizer al-Shamri told Saudi-owned Al Arabiya TV that he thinks there were over 100 passengers on the tour boat and that only 4 people were saved. Shamri blamed the owners of the tour boat for allowing too many people to board the ship. He says rapid currents on the river made it impossible to rescue many people. Parliament member Ahmed Jabouri claimed the boat was carrying more than 150 passengers and that casualty figures could rise dramatically. Most of the bodies, he insists, were carried away by the rapid current and have probably been taken away to the south of Mosul. Unconfirmed reports asserted that members of several prominent Shiite militia groups, popularly known as Hashd-e-Shaabi, reportedly owned the tour boat that capsized. Arab media reports say that Prime Minister Adel Abdel Mahdi cut short meetings in Baghdad to travel to Mosul. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
And thanks for joining us. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.